Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, for the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to talk a lot about the enemies, foreign and domestic, and what they're up to and why it matters, and most especially, why it should matter to you, with initially our great friend Bill Walton, the host of The Bill Walton Show, the master of the universe, now recovering from his days on Wall Street, also president of the Council for National Policy, of which I'm proud to be a member. He is a man of many parts indeed, and we're always delighted to have a chance to visit with him about this time each week. Welcome back, Bill. It's good to have you.
Frank, it's great to be on, and I also want to commend everybody to your appearance on Steve Bannon last week. I'm sure it's still airing, and it was a tour de force in 20 minutes. Actually, I don't think I'm going to have anything to talk about today. You covered it all.
Well, I get most of my good lines from you, so let's see what we can cook up for Steve's next appearance. Okay. We wanted to start with something that he and I did talk about, though, Bill, and you've commented on several different aspects of this with similar findings from various other sources. But the Wall Street Journal put it on the front page above the fold last week, the following article with a gripping headline, quote, "Wall Street falls out of love with pouring money into China." Now, this is something Steve was very complimentary about, the work of our Committee on the Present Danger of China, which I'm proud to say you are a member, in trying to bring this about, and what a, you know, important development it is, if true. Do you think it is true? And if so, is this a temporary sort of slowdown in the pouring of money, or do you think this is the end of the affair?
I think it's a bad marriage. I think this has been continuing for years, and they've been falling in and out of love, but they've been in love until recently. And you and I have covered this extensively. And the interesting piece of that story was Mike Gallagher, the great congressman from Wisconsin, who's been doing a lot of work on telling us about what we need to do about China. And he's absolutely right. He made the trek up to Wall Street to sit down with the financial mavens up there to tell them they've got to stay away from China. And I guess within the first 5 minutes of the meeting, they sort of said to him, well, you know, we already are. And it's like, it's what you and I've talked about in the past. These people are economic actors, first, foremost, most, and always. And China, as we've talked about, has become virtually uninvestable. And these guys cannot give up the idea that they could have made more billions from China, but that was the old set of rules, and a new set of rules are very hostile.
Yeah, and I want to get into some of those new rules, but Bill, just for the purposes of illustrating the point, I don't think that you would have described the meeting of the 400, Steve calls them traitors, in San Francisco as people who have fallen out of love with China. If anything, they seem to be, you know, bromancing with Xi Jinping big time. Some of them were Wall Street guys. Many were not. But it really seemed as though the bloom was still on the rose as far as they were concerned.
I didn't read it that way. I think that was kabuki theater. They did what they had to do. Because they've, you know, Steve Schwarzman has a couple hundred million dollars invested personally in the Schwarzman Scholar Program in China. Ray Dalio has been going there since 1984. His son was an intern in China. Bridgewater, his firm, has, I don't know, I think their fund now is $4 billion in China. They've got a lot to protect.
Oh, it's got to be more than a billion. $4 billion.
No, $4 billion is about what they've got in China.
Is that all?
They've got a standalone China. Well, that doesn't count everything else they've got in offshore investment accounts and that sort of thing. That's just, but that was big fanfare because his was the first fund that they allowed to happen. I think it was back in 2017. Anyway, these guys have an enormous financial and emotional commitment to China. And so when Xi shows up, yeah, they're going to give them a standing ovation, as repugnant and as disgusting as that is. I think they have to, because they're trying to protect the assets of their companies. And so what they're doing behind Crow's closed doors and with their portfolio is, though, another matter. And I think that's what Mike Gallagher came across, is that they're quietly looking for exits, but exiting, and U.S. investments in China total almost $2 trillion or maybe more. That's going to be hard to do overnight, and they're going to have to do it very carefully.
Yeah. Well, and for reasons that we're going to get into with you next, Bill, it's clear that Xi Jinping is being rather heavy-handed, I think it's fair to say, particularly with his own people, of course, which is their tradition, but to some extent with these Western companies. I was struck by Moody's, which downgraded China as an investable position the other day, told its people to hunker down at home, don't leave home. This speaks to that point, doesn't it, about it's a hostile environment?
Well, one of the things we say here in the States with when it comes to the administration is that personnel is policy. And looking at China, that is true in spades. About five, 6 months ago, Xi put his head of security, one of the toughest hands in China, head of all the financial regulation. And you know, his portfolio includes their version. Well, no. And you know, the way the Chinese work, well, the way any powerful people, you know, any totalitarian works, they make examples of people. And he took over the agencies regulating financial firms and began going in to due diligence firms and rounding people up and questioning them. And they've got strong rules in China about writing anything negative about the Chinese economy. And when Moody's announces that they're thinking about downgrading China, every single red light, every single bell and whistle went off there. And Moody's personnel basically thought correctly, we better not come into the office or we'll be next.
Yeah. Well, imagine they know where they live as well, no?
Yeah, you can't hide in China. I mean, that's another story. You can't leave China without them knowing. You can't stay in China without them knowing where you are.
Right. And what you're up to and where you bank and who you work for and the whole social credit score system. And I think that the other tell that was very interesting was the report that the Chinese have made the problem of youth unemployment, which is staggeringly high. As I recall, it was something like 28%, something like that, the last time I checked. How did they make that disappear, Bill?
Well, they solved the problem, Frank.
They did.
They stopped reporting the statistic.
I see. Hence,
it's nowhere to be found. As soon as word got out that youth unemployment, and that's age, 16 to 25, which is, by the way, the prime age for military recruits, that's at a record high, and the Chinese didn't want word out about it, so they shut down the statistics, which is why when everything coming out of China with statistics or their propaganda, we ought to know what it is.
Yeah, well, take it with a grain of salt at the very least. But Bill, I mean, you made a very interesting point. The one of the upshots, as you know, of the one child, population control measures that they long practiced has been to give rise to, in that same age cohort, as I recall, something like a 40 million woman shortfall.
Yeah.
Because they were, sexually selective in their abortion practices. So these guys have a lot of reason to be unhappy with the regime. We're going to talk on the other side of a short break with Bill Walton about why that may not be good news for us. So stay tuned for more with Bill Walton, the host of The Bill Walton Show, great friend of this program, member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, and more. Stay tuned.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The ruling mullahs of Iran are known as Twelvers. They believe that their messiah, the 12th imam, will emerge from a well in the city of Qom, usher in the golden age of Islam, and that this will be accomplished very soon. Unfortunately, this event requires an outpouring of appeals for help arising from death and destruction that sounds a lot like the apocalypse. Had the Iranian regime's incipient access to nuclear weapons that could be used to precipitate such a horror, and the three Obama-Biden administrations enriching, empowering, and emboldening of the Twelvers is clearly insane. Yet, Iranian and proxy attacks on our forces go unanswered. Money keeps flowing to Tehran, and its agents are demonstrably inside our wire. We must stop funding, appeasing, and otherwise enabling the mullah's ambitions, and instead help Israel disarm them while we still can. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. Bill Walton is in the house virtually. We're always delighted to be able to say that, especially at a moment such as this when we're watching evidence of the wheels coming off the Chinese Communist Party's train in important respects. And Bill, before the break, we were talking a little bit about this demographic catastrophe of a large number of, first of all, there aren't that enough young people to support all the old people, but among the young people they have, lots of them are unemployed. Disproportionately, they're male because of their one-child policy. And that's a very, you know, dangerous brew for a totalitarian regime. Historically, though, they have, the Chinese Communist Party specifically, but I think the ideological totalitarians of various stripes have opted for a specific safety valve when they get into that kind of trouble. What would that be, sir?
Well, young man, you can find a job. We have a place for you in the People's Republican Army.
And People's Liberation Army.
People's
right.
Liberation Army, sorry, yeah. PLA.
And not only that, but we've got places for you to see around the world.
I confuse them with the Irish. Anyway, it's 150 million young people, 16 to 25, probably 60, 65% of them are young men. They've got a lot of structural employment problems in the country. Productivity in Japan or in China has been falling dramatically in the last decade. It's now at all-time lows. Their population growth has peaked because of the one-child policy in part, and is projected to decline, throughout the century. And they've got an overbuilding. They've massively invested in infrastructure. One province has the poorest province in China has like 120 new bridges and 17 airports. And there are pictures of this airport with one customer in it, or one potential flyer in it. It's massively overinvested. But the way to get out of that mess is to start the consumer economy, start a service economy up. And Xi does not want to do that. And he is he's not going to let that happen. So you're right, a totalitarian ruler sitting on top of a demographic and economic powder keg, what are they likely to do? Well, they're likely to start thinking about Taiwan.
And the interesting question I think that we've been exploring, as you know, with our Committee on the Present Danger China webinar series is how Gordon Chang has talked about this as kind of a game of go for the Chinese. How do you strategically change the circumstances that will enable you when you decide to go for it in Taiwan? You may be able to take it without fighting, which is, of course, the acme of strategy, according to Sun Tzu. But Bill, the point is that if you are looking for a safety valve externally, it might help explain why it seems to be Xi Jinping is relentlessly setting fires. I call him a strategic arsonist. Actually, I think I've graduated him to a pyromaniac, because what we're seeing is, in Ukraine, Eastern Europe, what we're seeing in the Middle East with Israel, we're seeing, of course, possibly closer to home in Latin America, Venezuela, Guyana, does appear to be deliberate things that are going badly and distracting the United States, going to deplete its resources, going to disable it, perhaps, when his own aggression begins, perhaps in the not too distant future. Do you find that a credible scenario?
Well, I think it's absolutely right. China's taking big advantage of what Russia-Ukraine is all about. He's been supporting Russia and helping helping support what's happening there. There are also a lot of fingerprints, China, Iran, Hamas, Gaza, the attack in Israel. They're clearly in that in the background there, the Middle East. And it's a world on fire benefits Xi. It does not benefit us. And he's taking advantage of it. And, you know, there are five or six scenarios to take over Taiwan. I didn't realize until recently that there are a couple of Taiwanese islands. It's not just one island that are within swimming distance of mainland China. And I think probably what we might see next is a nibble rather than a gulp.
Yeah. You know, we're also seeing some Jaws action, if I can use that metaphor, around the Philippines.
Yeah.
Which is getting very sporty indeed. But Bill, you know, one of the things that is a little bit of good news, I suppose, with respect to these ambitions of Xi's to dominate the planet, using, among other things, the brush fires, yes, but also his Belt and Road Initiative. And I wanted to ask you about the fact that Giorgia Meloni is taking Italy out of the Belt and Road Initiative. We've not heard much from her since she became prime minister in Italy, but this is a rather important step, don't you think?
I think it's a big step, and it just shows the promise of Belt and Road, which was, of course, Xi's big initiative. He started in 2012, 2013. They have almost $1 trillion in loans all over the world to mostly developing countries, but he added Italy at a time when Italy was in a lot of trouble under a center-left regime. And the promise of that was that they were going to get some infrastructure money from China, and they were going to be integrated more into the Chinese economy, and Italian exports would rise. Well, what's happened instead is that Italian exports to China have either flatlined or fallen, while China's exports into Italy have doubled, maybe tripled in that time. I don't have the precise numbers. So the benefits that they thought they were getting, China didn't deliver. So she made a cold-eyed calculation. Hey, we don't need this. And she doesn't.
One of the other imports from China, of course, was the coronavirus, which really took its toll on Italy. It was one of the hardest hit places on the planet. And I think that Giorgia Meloni and her economy are still struggling with the repercussions of that. So another good reason for not wanting large numbers of Chinese to enter. Bill, let me just come back to that point, because one of the things that you and I talk about frequently is the impact on the United States of having large numbers of Chinese enter. And not least, going back to something we touched on earlier, a lot of them seem to be in that demographic cohort, but not just, you know, run-of-the-mill young Chinese men who are unemployed, but some who seem to bear the hallmarks of Chinese special forces. And the idea that they're coming over the border in large numbers. When I heard Dick Durbin say the other day, as you may know, Bill, that Senator Durbin, senior senator from Illinois, that, you know, one of the really good things about this illegal immigration and having the border open and all that is that it might help us solve the recruiting shortfall problem with the United States military. What do you make of that? Oh, you laugh. It's no laughing matter. This guy was perfectly serious.
Dick Durbin.
What could go wrong here? And that, by the way, Bill, that doesn't include the jihadis who are also here in large numbers.
Blithering idiot or on the take, and probably both.
Well, the question occurs, is that part of the plan for the Biden administration?
Let's just refer to something I said earlier. You cannot get out of China without the Chinese Communist Party permission. And the idea that we've got 10, 15, 20, 30,000 young men showing up at our southern, well, it used to be a border. Now it's just a, it's a welcome turnstile. And then most likely those young men are trained to be agents inside of the United States. Surprise, surprise. We found how many, we found one biological lab already, and there are probably many others. This infiltration continues, but for Durbin to say something like that, they're healthy young men ready to join our army,
serve our country,
is beyond. I mean, I shouldn't laugh,
I mean, it is ridiculous, and that's why I think you're laughing. But unfortunately, he's deadly serious about it. I fear some in the Biden administration maybe as well. Bill, we have to leave it at that. The time has flown by as it always does with you. Yeah. But I hope you'll come back for more punishment next week. Until then, my friend, thank you. God bless you, and keep up the great work at the Bill Walton Show. Amen. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and a very, very happy occasion it is, because I happen to have gotten my hands, since last we spoke with the author of this book, The Radical Mind, subtitled The Destructive Plans of the Woke Left, David Horowitz, to have the book now with me and to have begun taking it aboard. It's a very important work, one of innumerable books and countless articles and many other pronouncements, interviews, and so on that David has shared with us over a lifetime of, a very interesting trajectory. As those of you who have followed his career know, he started out as a red diaper baby and was for quite some time a prominent, if not actually leading figure in the radical left. Only along came Ronald Reagan, and about that time, David Horowitz realized that he was batting for the wrong team and became instead a leading voice on the conservative side of the political spectrum. I've been privileged to know and work with him for decades in that capacity and learned much from him, and especially to take stock with it all about the book, the movement, where we are. It's a pleasure, as always, to have David with us. Welcome back, David, once again.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you for those kind words.
Well, they're heartfelt, and I think mostly true, as what happens. David, I wanted to start by just sort of getting a quick sort of snapshot of what we're up against in the United States at the moment in terms of radical minds.
I've had really one mission since entering the right, because the right is goes way back in our country to the founding. What I saw when I came, when I woke up and saw how malicious our campaigns on the left were, and I saw how polite Republicans and conservatives were, I knew that was my calling, was to expose this radical evil. And that's the only way you can describe it.
Yes, exactly right. But yeah. So let me give you an example of just how radical and evil it is. A fellow traveler with the Marxist left, is a fellow by the name of Nihad Awad. And he is one of the founders and the current president of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. And David, your wonderful website, Discovering the Networks, and Front Page Magazine, and of course, Robert Spencer's great work at jihadwatch.org, have done a lot to expose these sorts of individuals, the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas specifically. But a very interesting thing happened the other day at some function of this Sharia supremacist clique here in the United States. Nihad actually avowed that he was, quote, happy, unquote, at what the Gazans, as he called them, did on October 7th to Israel.
Yeah, this is the head of CARE.
This is the head of the Council on American Islamic
Relations. And they have a working partnership with the FBI.
Right.
And that's all you need to know about the treason that's going on at the top of our country.
Amen. And the Department of Homeland Security, as well as the intelligence community, as well as the military, this guy's, and the White House itself. This guy's been thick as thieves with all
of them. We have a president who's in Xi Jinping's, whatever his name is, pocket.
Controlled asset.
I always get that wrong. It's like ping pong.
But David, here's the question to you is when you realize that guys like this who work for Hamas, I mean, that's his job, are not only deeply penetrating the government of the United States, but shaping its policies. This has got to be, you know, what the radical left has striven for a century or more. What do we do about it to both recognize it first, obviously, but to correct it?
It really begins with the calling of things by their right names. We have a criminal administration in Washington. Nobody with two eyes and a halfway open mind can fail to see that. And we need more people saying that. We need more Elon Musks. Not everybody. You have to look at Elon Musk this way, that yes, he has tremendous resources to defend himself, but yes, also he has tremendous resources that he can lose by sticking his neck out. And actually, the Soviets had this saying during the Cold War that the cornstalk that sticks its neck out up highest gets its head chopped off first. And that's why we don't have people calling things by their right names. So everybody up and down the ladder of power and success has a responsibility to stand up for the country now. Finally, what's going on our TV screens with these Harvard traitors, the rot in our universities is so great, we have to stop funding them with federal tax dollars. Not the hard sciences, but all the liberal arts should be cut off. Every federal dollar that goes to a liberal arts program should be cut off until these universities end their, it's not just their Jew-hating policies for one, but much more important, their America-hating policies.
Anti-American, yeah. David, it's interesting you say that because I'm concerned that one of the things, and you've done just tremendous work in the universities over the years, trying to protect students' rights, among other things, and standing up against anti-Semitism and the woke pedagogy and so on. Cultural Marxist is actually my preferred term for it rather than woke. But David, here's the thing. Even the hard sciences are now being taught in a way that suggests woke too.
That's a tough one, defunding the medical schools. So you have, I'm mentally doing the arithmetic. just about 25 years ago, I launched a campaign for academic freedom in our universities. And it just stipulated that education be professional. And my model was the Columbia University I went to as a young man. And of course...
Not the Columbia Teachers College, however.
No.
Which was a source of a lot of the problem that we've got in this regard.
You know, it's got Perry David writing, you know, Billy Ayers did their series of social justice.
Writing the curriculum, no less. Yeah. But David, we're going to have 3 minutes or so left, and I just wanted to try to hone in on one thing, because, again, you have an understanding of how the radical mind works and what we're up against. In your professional judgment, are we at the cusp of another summer of love?
Oh,
or a better expression in the run-up to the next election?
I hate to look into my crystal ball because I see just flames and death. I think the Americans are waking up pretty fast now. Thanks, you know, to this horrible massacre, unimaginable that we would have in Israel, that we would have hundreds of thousands of young people and Harvard presidents defending a call for the extermination of the Jews with the Holocaust pretty much fresh in our minds.
Right. And yet we have Nihat Awad's friends out in the streets with the left locking arms, you know, calling for, you know, freeing Gaza and Palestine and from the river to the sea and all that.
The left, who conservatives think a terrible and it could be a fatal mistake of referring to as liberals, had a slogan in the 60s, the worse the better. I remember Tom Hayden explaining to me why it was important to elect a fascist, this is his description, like Nixon, over a liberal like Hubert, an anti-communist liberal like Hubert Humphrey. The left's agendas are evil. They're destructive. Leftists wake up every day thinking about how to undermine our institutional framework, the most successful political framework in the history of the world.
Yeah. And you say that on the basis of having
no thought
in that space yourself, right?
No thought to how you have a successful society. You certainly don't have it by opening your borders to 8 million unvetted felons and terrorists and people who are just, you know, culturally deprived and have a hard time conducting their lives in a civil manner.
To say nothing, if they're jihadis or they're Chinese People's Liberation Army special operators, this will not end well. David, we have to leave it at that for the moment. We're going to come back to you soon. Thank you for your time today, my friend. Thank you for this newest contribution to our understanding of what we're up against. God bless you. David Horowitz with The Radical Mind. Come back soon. We'll be right back with more. Stay tuned.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The ruling mullahs of Iran are known as Twelvers. They believe that their messiah, the 12th imam, will emerge from a well in the city of Qom, usher in the golden age of Islam, and that this will be accomplished very soon. Unfortunately, this event requires an outpouring of appeals for help arising from death and destruction that sounds a lot like the apocalypse. Add the Iranian regime's incipient access to nuclear weapons that could be used to precipitate such a horror, and the three Obama-Biden administrations enriching, empowering, and emboldening of the Twelvers is clearly insane. Yet, Iranian and proxy attacks on our forces go unanswered. Money keeps flowing to Tehran, and its agents are demonstrably inside our wire. We must stop funding, appeasing, and otherwise enabling the mullah's ambitions, and instead help Israel disarm them while we still can. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back, and it's a great moment to be visited by our duty genius around here. His name is George Raceley. He is a Mensa Society member. Don't take my word for it. Take theirs. He is one of the most accomplished political, well, practitioners I know, not so much because he has run for office himself, but because he has helped some 300 people do just that. Mm-hmm. And he has, as a result, got enormous expertise and certainly a lot of experience, much of which he helps the rest of us by illuminating what is going on in the, well, as they call it, mundo political, the political world, from his vantage point as the editor-in-chief of Richard Viguerie's terrific newsletter, Conservative HQ. George Raceley, it's great to have you back. Always welcome once again.
Well, thank you very much, Frank. And in fact, I did run for office once, and I got two-thirds of the vote in a three-man race. So
how about that? Does that mean you won?
I did.
Oh, congratulations.
Much to my chagrin, I won.
Well, congratulations. I'll have to add that into your resume now. I'll have to find out what it was for, but we'll do that on another occasion. Listen, George, you've used your platform at Conservative HQ to amplify some messaging that we think is absolutely urgently needed to be as widely shared and understood by the American people as we can. And that is what's being done to the United States military by the Biden administration. I call it a Marxist makeover.
Yeah.
And it's now manifesting itself in lots of different ways. Give us some of the subjects that are most concerned to you.
Well, you know, as an Army brat, the thing that is the underlying thing that is most concerning to me is the end of meritocracy in the military. And what's it's being replaced by is some sort of weird sort of, well, it's straight up diversity, equity, and inclusion, which means that people are recruited and promoted on the basis of skin color, sexual orientation, et cetera, et cetera. And the inclusion,
all the various identities.
Yeah, the identities. And the inclusion part of that means that this is not optional. You know, you have to go out and find someone that fits into some minority category, real or imagined, and then put them into a slot, whether they're capable or not. And that to me is a disaster, not just for the culture of our military, but for its effectiveness and for the defense of the nation.
Yeah. You know, it comes down to this, doesn't it? At the end of the day, you're asking people to put their lives on the line for the country. And much of that has to do with their confidence in the person next to them. And
absolutely,
their competence and their ability to hold their own and protect you and so forth. And
yeah.
It's just so appalling. And yet the thing that is subtly doubly appalling about it, George, as you know, is that the United States Senate has essentially stopped serving in the role that the Constitution envisioned for them of being sort of quality control officers on the kind of people who are being promoted. Talk a little bit about Senator Tommy Tuberville's efforts to buck that trend.
You know, Tuberville is one of the unsung heroes of this decade, in my opinion. He stood virtually alone, and it started out to be just a fight against Biden's illegal abortion policy in the, you know, at the Pentagon, and it's morphed into a real look at the effects of this DEI on the military, and in particular, on flag officers adopting it, and not just promoting it as a good idea, but essentially enforcing it in their commands and aggressively. And Tuberville, to his great credit, and I think because of his background as an athletic coach, understands meritocracy better than anybody. You know, you don't put a guy that can't throw in as pitcher. You don't put a guy that can't kick in as punter. And you don't put a guy who can't run in
anywhere.
Yeah.
Right. And not an athletic competition, that's for sure. Yeah. So, George, this is ultimately resulted in even members of his own party betraying him for the hold that he placed on hundreds of these dubious candidates for promotion in the military. Yeah. And some improvements that were made by the House of Representatives to the underlying policies mm-hmm. were all stripped out in the National Defense Authorization Act conference report, as they call it. What are we to make of this? And more to the point, what are we to do about it?
Well, you know, there's what I call a uniparty consensus on this, that they're not going to actually hold anyone in government accountable anywhere, be it the military or the civil service side, for these policies. And it's just shameful that some of the people who should be most familiar with this in terms of their responsibilities in the Senate in particular are just MIA. I mean, they won't fight. Joni Ernst, you know, who has a military background and should understand this better than anyone, absolutely on the wrong side of this.
Yeah. Similarly, Dan Sullivan, Alaska.
Sullivan, yeah.
Same very there. Aggressively so.
It's just shameful.
Yeah. It's shameful. I guess that's one way of describing it. But again, going back to what you said earlier, it's perilous.
Dangerous.
Not least because of what it means for readiness and unit cohesion and deterrence, but also the extent to which our enemies are taking stock of all of this I think very unlikely to be deterred by what they're seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, well, sorry, you know, we can't put Patton or Schwarzkopf in charge of the next operation because, you know, we need
too somebody many white that males.
Fits. Yeah, we need somebody that fits into one of these weird made up minority categories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's got to be diversity and equity and, of course, inclusion. Yeah. So, George, when we talk about all this, and we're over time, we're going to stop. We'll be right back with more with George Raceley right after this. Welcome back. George Raceley is in the house virtually. We're always delighted to be able to say that. He brings the wealth of experience of 300 political campaigns and his role these days as the editor-in-chief of Conservative HQ to our conversations, for which we're very grateful. So on the Hill, in addition to making a hash-up of the Defense Authorization Act, the Congress is also, it seems, going through, you know, a kind of kabuki dance about appropriations. And as I recall, one of the things that cost Kevin McCarthy his job in the Speaker of the House role was that, you know, he had promised that he was going to have 12 different appropriations measures coming out of the House, and he didn't deliver it. And now, alas, it seems as though the man who was ultimately chosen to succeed him, Mike Johnson, is falling prey to a similar kind of inertia and yielding to inevitably the Senate's insistence on just having either continuing resolutions ad infinitum, or worse yet, a new kind of omnibus bill in which they put everything in one box and, as Nancy Pelosi used to say, we'll know what's in it after it's over.
Yeah. Well, I'll give Johnson a little bit of latitude in, you know, his newness and the fact that he's really got a learning curve and a stature curve to, you know, pass through to run these appropriation bills through the House, particularly with such a small majority. But at the end of the day, small and declining. But the end of the day is that the Senate and many of the senior House members want to govern by crisis. It gives them more power. It gives them less accountability. And so passing next year's spending bills at midnight on Christmas Eve means that nobody knows what's in it, and that they bear no responsibility because it's a take it or leave it package. And you don't know whose fingerprints are on what objectionable provision in the bill. And so, you know, this has become the habit in Washington over the last decade. It certainly wasn't the way things were done when you and I were working on the Hill.
Back when men were men.
I remember, back in the ancient times.
Right. But you know, George, a prime example of this, I have to tell you, is going back to the National Defense Authorization Act. Last year, this is must-pass legislation each year, turns out. And so all kinds of Christmas trees get thrown into the mix. One 11-page act called the Pandemic Preparedness and Prevention Act, or something to that effect, was tucked in at page 950 of a 1,700-page defense bill, and lo and behold, it passed out money and it gave authorities and it committed the United States to conform to anything that the World Health Organization came up with as a agreement for how it is going to proceed in the future. And this is the thing I wanted to turn to next with you, George, is the World Health Organization has become a really serious problem, just as an advisory body in its present role, but it is poised to become a dictatorial body, unbelievably. What are we to make of that? Well, and why... isn't it kind of a problem that, unbeknownst to anybody, apparently, we've now pre-approved whatever they come up with in a defense authorization bill?
Yeah, well, this is an ongoing problem with Democrats in charge, is that they are bent on giving away the sovereignty of the United States into these globalist organizations. Yeah.
In the name of global governance.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's completely unconstitutional, in my opinion. And I think many constitutional scholars would agree with that. In addition, it's the WHO is, in essence, a red Chinese front group. I mean, it'd be one thing to, you know, give away our sovereignty to some good guys, but we're giving it away to the bad guys.
Right. What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah.
And you know, among the bad guys, by the way, it's not just the, as you call them, the Red Chinese. It's Bill Gates.
Yeah.
It's the World Economic Forum. It's Big Pharma. I mean, yeah. All of these guys are special interests or, you know, other influencers on this organization. And one of the key points, and we're excited that there's a hearing coming up this week in the United States House of Representatives on Wednesday, in which the subcommittee that was created in the Oversight Committee responsible for looking into the COVID pandemic is having a hearing on the idea of reforming this institution. And I'm hopeful that what they're going to realize is, wait a minute, among other things, this outfit has no special expertise. This is not a more knowledgeable, more capable group of people than, say, you know, our own medical authorities. In fact, I think it's substantially worse. But George, here's the thing. This is rocketing through as things stand now. They will, in May, give the director general of the WHO the kind of global governance powers of which you spoke a moment ago, to tell us when we have a public health emergency of international concern, as they call it, and what we have to do about it. Now, you have prominently displayed in the background of your shot there, rifles. I know you're an expert marksman. You're a trainer for the National Rifle Association and so on. Do you think there's any chance, George, that a guy who thinks that climate change is a public health emergency and has to be dealt with, or that, you know, how we treat illegal immigrants coming into our country is a public health, is going to come to the conclusion that gun violence is a public health emergency, and that what needs to be done about it is you need to confiscate those guns there, dude, not just the pictures.
You can take it to the bank that the minute that agreement goes into effect, the anti-gun groups in the United States will start demanding.
They'll be all over it. George, I'm so sorry. We're hard out of time. I had so much fun. Come back with more as soon as you can. I hope the rest of you will come back next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.